Miss Efron, your book, Crazy Salad, is almost exclusively about women, which is fair enough. I guess you are considered one of the leading spokeswomen, spokespersons, for the women's liberation movement, although I assume you would disavow that identification.
You assume correctly.
Why?
Well, because I don't think I speak for anyone but myself, and if you've had anything to do with the women's movement, you find out very quickly that there's no way to speak for it. So there you are.
I guess it would be a little like speaking for a kaleidoscope, wouldn't it?
Yes, it's a very wide group of people, as any movement is, really, mm-hmm. and they have trouble getting together on most things. And some of them consider me this hopeless revisionist, and some of them consider me right on, and some of them think I'm, you know, I don't know what, but there's no way you can speak for a movement that really disagrees as much as it does.
Well, on second thought, I take the whole thing back, my whole remark, because I remember how well you took them apart in a couple of the pieces in here after attending some meetings. You were not awfully impressed with some of the meetings, I think.
Well, you know, in one way it's not fair, because theoretically if we really believed in women's lib, we ought to believe that women can be as abusive to one another as men are. But still, when I went, for example, to the Democratic Convention in Miami and watched the amount of time and energy that was wasted in squabbles over who was going to open which session, it was rather disheartening to me.
What, incidentally, is Betty Friedan doing now?
Well, the last I read, which was yesterday, she was attacking Gloria Steinem again. Mm. So I had the feeling that nothing had changed at all.
It's a little old hat, isn't it?
She was also in Mexico City for the International Women's Year, which may explain why so little happened there.
Well, what's the future? What's going to happen finally? Will things just simmer down and women will get the same treatment as everybody else and then the thing will be over?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that basically, and I don't know, you understand this, I'm winging this, but I think that it's not going to be about the women's movement per se as it was 3 or 4 years ago. We're not going to have big demonstrations and things like that. What we are going to have is more of the right women elected to office, many more legal victories, and that will be going on one side. And on the other side, I think there's no question but that the message of the movement has gotten across mm-hmm. to the most unlikely people. It's always interesting to see how many people who would never have corrected themselves from saying the word girl, to use a very minor example, kind of catch themselves at it now. It's interesting to see how many women whom you think would be untouched by the movement are kind of starting to think about whether or not they really should be responsible mm-hmm. for a job plus all the household things. There are a lot of changes going on, and they aren't quite as visible as they were 3 or 4 years ago. So people think the movement's gone away, but it hasn't at all, I don't think.
It's shaken down, really, and gotten more solid, I'm sure.
Yes, I think so.
And more workable.
I do think so.
I think you're right. Your book is full of highly readable pieces, as I'm sure you've been told many times, both by reviewers and readers. And I think the one that made me the saddest was the one about
Bernice Guerra.
The lady umpire who never got a chance.
Oh, it was, I tell you, I went to see her. Bernice Guerra, as you remember, was
a
baseball nut who wanted to be an umpire. And after I don't know how many years of going to umpire school where she was totally abused by the other men, and fighting, I think, 3 or 4 years in the courts, finally got a job umpiring a minor league game. And she did, you know, what of course was supposed to happen was that she was supposed to go on to be the greatest umpire in baseball history. And what happened instead was that she
made a bad call.
She made a bad call. She kind of got shaken up by it. She burst into tears and she left baseball after this one game. And in a horrible sense, seemed on the surface to be proving that they'd been right about women in baseball all along. And I thought it was such a terrible story. And I went to visit her a few months after it happened. And I was depressed for days afterward, because you go into this little apartment in Queens.
And it's a shrine.
And it's a shrine to baseball. It's flower arrangements shaped like mitts, and pictures of bats on the wall, and equipment everywhere, and little stuffed animals, and around her neck a little bat and ball on a gold chain. And this woman wanted this more than anything in the world. I just wanted to die. I really felt awful about it. So mm-hmm. It's a very sad story,
I
think.
It was, and it came over as a very sad story, and you felt extremely melancholy about Bernice Guerra. I don't suppose she'll ever get another chance now.
Well, I don't know. I don't think so. She kept assuring me that she wasn't through in baseball, but it seems pretty clear that she is. You know, I'm always so fascinated as to why people want to take this kind of thing on, because the abuse that you suffer if you are a pioneer is so extraordinary. I could never put up with it. And she had gone through so many years of men saying what they thought were mm-hmm. jokes about her chest protector. Ha, ha, ha. And you know, and on, also you think, why would anyone want to get into baseball? I mean, this is another thing that is utterly baffling to me. Basketball, maybe. I think I could imagine wanting to get into. But baseball, it's crazy.
What's the matter with that?
I don't know why anyone would want to get into it.
What about golf?
No,
or tennis.
Tennis, you know. We all want to get into tennis.
Are you an admirer of Billie Jean's, by
yes,
the way?
Yes, I am. I think she's fantastic. I love her. I think she's beautiful. I mean, really physically beautiful. And so much more fun to watch than almost any tennis player, I think. And she's changed the whole sport.
Well, I think, actually, I'm not a great admirer of hers, but I agree with one thing she said, that women's tennis is more fun to watch than men's.
Yes, it is.
Because the rallies last longer.
But her women's tennis is more fun to watch than other women's tennis. You know, her exuberance and her fury, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, she's an attacker.
Yes.
As DeRocha says, she comes to kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to watch. Guligong, I'm so sorry to see her demolished so completely, though.
Well, I was happy to see Billie Jean King really? Win. I thought it was a wonderful Wimbledon. Get to see Jimmy Connors beaten.
Arthur Ashe? Oh, well, I'm delighted about Ashe. Yeah.
I mean, almost anyone could have beaten Jimmy Connors and it would have been okay with me.
You can be malevolent, can't you?
Oh, sure.
It's kind of fun to be malevolent.
No, I mean...
I'll tell you something you were malevolent in. Your piece on Julie Nixon.
You have a soft spot for Julie
Nixon.
I like
Julie, yes.
Well, I don't. Yeah. I think she's a chocolate-covered spider.
You said that.
And
yeah.
I think she's a true Nixon, and that to think of her in any other way is a terrible mistake. I think that she really lived through him in a way that the political wives do. It's a rare political daughter whose father's career becomes as obsessive as that one was. I don't think she's all sweetness and light at all. No, sir.
You're a highly suspicious person.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite piece in there or a favorite person in your book?
Well, I think probably I like the piece on the feminine hygiene sprays, on how they were marketed.
That was a very well, I would gather, researched piece. You must have done, was that first in Esquire for whom
yes,
you worked?
Yes, it was in Esquire, and it was odd because I wanted to do it, and then as I was working on it, the hexachlorophene thing happened, and it turned out that the sprays were actually dangerous as well as I felt fairly evil products. So it took me a long time to do it because I had to kind of wait for the Food and Drug Administration to
make
get
up his
moving.
Mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was their final ruling, or they changed it several times?
They took, hexachlorophene had to be taken out of them.
I knew that, yeah.
Yeah.
But otherwise, they're...
They're still in the market, but they don't sell very much anymore, I'm happy to say.
So. Well, it was a promotion to start with. It was purely a money-making promotion to start with, wasn't it?
Well, yes, but they believed in it deeply, and all these men that you talked to really felt that they had... You know, the first person who told me that that it was a product that dated back to biblical times, I laughed at. But then, of course, I began thinking about it, and I realized that he was absolutely right, that there's really no anthropological society that did not have some taboo about women's genital areas.
The mikveh and...
The mikveh for the Jews, mm-hmm. and far, far worse ones.
Well, talk about myrrh and incense, I'm sure.
Yes, and you know, there are still societies that bury women underground when they go through puberty and don't allow them to look at cows for fear that cows will stop giving milk. And so it became a much more interesting story, and I thought more significant one than I never thought it was in the beginning. At the beginning, I just thought it was a bunch of men trying to rip off women's fears about their own smells, you know.
What? How many pieces a year do you do for Esquire?
I do a piece a month in Esquire.
Piece a month.
Yeah.
And how long have you been? You're a freelancer, but.
But with, I have a contract.
With a contract with,
yeah,
Esquire. How long have you had it?
Well, I was with them for 2 years, and then I went to New York Magazine for a year, and now I've been back at Esquire about 8 months.
Clay Felker bought you.
Yes, he did indeed.
How do you like that magazine?
Well, as a friend of mine once said, I don't have too much trouble with my plants, so I don't read it that much. But it's all right. I couldn't work for him, and I had to leave. Mm. You know, couldn't stand it.
Have you had, you're a full-time freelance writer now.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had much trouble because you are a woman writer instead of a man writer?
Well, I think, sure, yes. There are always places who, when you start out for them, want you to do fashion pieces. The first job I had was at Newsweek magazine. I started as a male girl, and I was told straight off that women didn't become writers there. Well, you know, I was the most hopelessly driven young woman that you have ever seen. I was going to be a journalist if it killed me, and so I just managed to get a job somewhere else. So all of that, you know, all of that went on. I was extremely lucky because my mother had been a screenwriter, and I always knew that I would grow up and do something beyond getting married and having children or not, you know, that those were not what you grew up and did. You got a job and worked. And so I don't think that the problems of being a woman were quite as severe for me because I had a leg up, mm-hmm, from growing up in that household.
You graduated from Vassar.
Wellesley,
pardon me.
Yeah.
And you have a funny piece about going back for your... Was it the 10th reunion?
10th reunion, yes.
And pretending you weren't really part of it, that you came to cover it?
Oh, I know. I mean, you know, I just kept...
You know, you look so sweet, and you can be a fair to Lance.
Well, I don't know what to say to that.
I meant it as a compliment.
You know. Okay, thank you. I'll say thank you then. But, you know, about being a woman writer, it's odd because there are some things that I think are really difficult to do if you are a woman writer. And one thing is that it's very hard to cover police. People always think, oh, we'll send her. They used to do this to, yeah, me at the New York Post all the time. They thought that I would fool them in some way by looking so innocent or something. Well, the fact is that police would really rather talk to men. They don't know how to talk to women. They're true locker room boys. And you don't get from them what a good, solid Daily News police reporter is going to get.
Who's known them for years, too.
Yes, who has, yeah, certainly known them for years. And last year, this story is a little, can we take a little bit of a tacky story here?
I don't know.
Well, we'll try it. I hope it's funny, though. Last year, when I was in Israel covering, mm-hmm, the war, there were not a lot of women doing that. And it was fascinating to me, not only because the men who cover wars have a kind of Hemingway view of war as this great experience in which you see people behaving at their best, which I did not share. So there was that going on, which I felt very female during. But also, it is really harder to cover a war if you're a woman, not only because...
Unless you were Marguerite Higgins.
Well, she knew more members of the military than I did, But the thing that happened that I thought was terribly funny, and I hope it's not too tacky, one night we went to the war was over and we were going down to look at the ceasefire line. It was a few days after the war had ended. And there were two other reporters who were men and an escort officer and I, and we left Tel Aviv at 1 a.m. And you drive all night through the Sinai and you get to the canal at about 7 or 8 o'clock and you cross the canal and all of the men get out of the car and turn their backs and
stand there
and go to the bathroom and take care of things. And if you are a woman, you not only have to find a place that is not in full view of the entire Israeli army, but when you find it, they tell you that you can't go in there because it's mined. So it's a wonderful time for you. And anyway, I finally managed to muddle through, and we went on. We went down to Suez, and we went up to the ceasefire line at kilometer 101. And here was the Israeli tent with the Israeli colonel, and then all this barbed wire, and then there was the UN. And then about 150 yards down the road, there was this tent with these three Egyptian officers in front of it. And behind the big tent was a little tent, a little latrine. And I turned to one of the guys I'd gone there with, and I said, do you see that? Do you see that beautiful sight? And he said, Nora, you can't go there. It's across the ceasefire line. And I said, oh, yes, I can. And I then began this elaborate charade, pointing to the tent and pointing to myself, trying to get these Egyptians' attention. And finally, they saw me, and they started laughing. And what happened was that the Israeli colonel negotiated it with the UN, who negotiated it with the Egyptians, and I was the only reporter in the last word across the line.
You see, women have an unfair advantage.
Yes, well, not really, though. Was that too tacky?
No, I don't think so. It wouldn't have been funny if you'd become an international incident.
I don't think I was going to, because it had been so carefully negotiated. Listen, if they had negotiated the settlement as carefully as that was negotiated, we wouldn't be having
all this
trouble.
Yeah. It would still be settled. But you evaded my thing about Wellesley. Why did you pretend you were just there to cover it when really you went back to celebrate your 10th anniversary?
Well, I think it was very hard for me to admit that I cared at all about Wellesley College. You know, it's kind of, why would you want to do that, my friend said to me. You know, why would you want to go back to Reunion? And I kept saying, oh, I'm just going as a journalist. It will make a very interesting story. And it took me really the whole weekend to come to terms with the fact that I had really wanted to go, and I just had to pretend I didn't want to, that I was so far above it, you know, God forbid I should get any real pleasure from
it. You saw some other professional from the communications world marching, and she wasn't carrying her sign.
Well, it's funny, you know, at the end of those weekends, I mean, these schools are so insane, you know, and each class has a color. And you all march in the graduation parade, and each class is wearing this little thing. Our class's color was purple, so we were all supposed to carry open umbrellas with huge bunches of artificial purple violets and ribbons hanging from them. It wasn't raining. We were just supposed to carry them. Then there was a class that was all wearing little yellow chef's hats. And then there was a class that looked like they were wearing strawberry shortcakes on their heads. I don't know, it was insane. And I was standing there with my notebook, having deliberately left this tacky umbrella in my room. And I was taking notes on it. And suddenly I saw a woman who is a book editor coming down the hill with her class. And her class was all wearing red backpacks.
Who was it?
It was a woman named Jean Young, who's an editor at Lippincott.
Chinese.
Yes.
Yes, I know her.
And,
lovely lady.
Jean was marching with her class, but she was not wearing a backpack. And I looked at her and I thought, she thinks she's separate from this, just the way I do. She thinks that because she isn't wearing a backpack, she's somehow separated from all of this Mickey Mouse nonsense. But we're all here. And we all still care. And that makes us the biggest fools of all, you know. Incidentally, I told this to Jean several months later, and she said she'd merely forgotten to put hers on. So
Freudian, very Freudian.
Yes.
What reactions do you get from writing the piece on Julie, for example? Have you had adverse reactions to it?
Well, there was a lot of mail at New York Magazine about it from admirers of Julie Nixon like yourself. Mm-hmm. And
no, I had her on my other show once.
You did?
I did like her, yes.
But you know, you certainly don't get any reaction out of the White House on it, if that's what you mean. I don't think they noticed in the least, and you know.
Now, a lot of these are book reviews. Do you still do book reviews for the Esquire, too?
Yes, and I do book reviews for other places, for Ms. and for the Times.
What kind of book will you do next? Because obviously you must do more books than you've done.
What kind of book will I write next?
Yeah.
I don't know. I find that people always say to me, when are you going to do a real book? And it always reminds me...
I wish I'd said that.
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you didn't. But it always reminds me of when I was married and people would say to me, when are you going to have a baby? I don't know. I don't know that one ought to do either of those things necessarily. I hope something hits me.
But do you have any desire to do fiction, for example?
No, because I'm terrible at it. I'm such a kind of...
It doesn't stop a lot of other people whose books get published.
Well, but I'm a very ingrained journalist, and where it stops me is that whenever I try to take something and turn it into fiction, my way of doing that is by changing the colors of people's hair.
Yeah,
I think if I just turn this blonde into a brunette, that will fool everyone. They'll never guess who it is.
But you don't want to change the character.
And then I look at it and I say, but she is a blonde. If I make her a brunette, I lose everything. So I don't seem to be any good at it.
And you wouldn't want to change the character because it would be untrue to the person.
But you know, so often, you know, if you're a journalist, things happen and you say, thank God I'm a journalist, because if I wrote it as fiction, no one would believe it. And so I'm very happy dealing with what happens in life, you know.
I was surprised to find that Gloria Steinem is the sort who cries. You mentioned her weeping.
Well, I wasn't surprised to find that she was the sort of person who cried. What awed me about her, this was on the last day of the Democratic Convention, and the two of us were walking along, and she began talking about what McGovern had done to the women at the convention. And what awed me was that she was crying about that. I have never cried about anything remotely political in my life. I don't mean...
You would expect to be double-crossed, and she wouldn't, apparently.
Well, I think probably. I don't think I'm as naive as she was at that time about trusting politicians. And but, you know, most of the women I know and myself cry over very trivial things and personal things, especially personal things. She was crying... You know, for womankind, and I don't mean to put her down for that at all. It really knocked me out, and that was what surprised me.
Well, that's really kind of an admirable thing to cry for.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
I really do. I think she's fantastic.
I didn't mean to poke fun at it at all, but I was surprised to discover, because she seemed more sure of herself than that, you know, the only time I met her.
She's human.
Yeah, I suppose. You know? Well, obviously, yes. You have how many pieces in that book, by the way?
25.
25. That covers 2 years, roughly. They're all from Esquire.
No,
most
they're
of them.
Most from Esquire. Yes.
Or Rolling Stone, or something. Rolling
one
Stone.
One from
too.
Rolling Stone.
Which one was that?
The piece about Jan Morris.
Oh yes, yes. The English man hyphen woman.
Yes.
You were a little acerbic about that too.
Yes, I'm afraid I was. Well, you know, I was so surprised because I first read about that story at, you know, James Morris was a very well-known British journalist who climbed Mount Everest with Sir Edmund Hillary. And in his 40s, he decided, you know, he was married, he had four children, and he decided to become a woman, which is something he claimed to have wanted since he was 4 years old. And I first read about this story in the New York Times Magazine in the most wonderful story someone else wrote. And I was fascinated by it because I think we all have fantasies, most of which are unattainable. And there's something very interesting about someone who has a fantasy all his life that modern medicine makes attainable, and he gives into it. Instead of spending years with an analyst, he just says, well, okay, I'll go with it. And so I bought the book the second it hit the bookstores. And I read it, and to my surprise, found out that James Morris did not want to be a woman at all. What he wanted to be was a girl. And he had become this kind of hopelessly giddy 47-year-old girl who just loved it when waiters batted their eyes at her and changed her tires and loved gossiping with all her neighbors. And I was very sad because I thought, it's so much more interesting than that to be a woman now. It's probably more interesting being a woman now than it's ever been. And it's too bad that Jan Morris is missing out on some of that.
I thought it was a very sad, the whole incident was very sad. And I saw him on some things and found...
It's very confusing with the adjectives.
Him, her, very sad, yes. Yeah. Yeah. What gave you the most trouble in there? Which piece? I mean, to bring it off, to round it out, to make it the way you wanted it.
Well, I think the piece that I was the most nervous about was the piece that's the first piece in the book, which is called A Few Words About Breasts. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it without an assignment. And I had no idea whether...
You wrote it from memory.
Well, you know, I mean, no, I didn't call someone up and say, I want to do a piece on being...
No, what I meant was you were remembering what it was when you were little,
yes.
When you were young. Yeah.
Yes, and,
yeah.
You know, I didn't call up and get an assignment. I just sat at the typewriter and I wrote this thing about essentially being flat-chested in the 50s. And when you're doing something like that, you really don't know whether you've brought it off. You don't know whether you've written something that will make people say, yes, I'm so glad you wrote that, or whether people say, oh God, another tacky confession. I think I've used the word tacky so many times on this show, I'm breaking some sort of record, but anyway.
I think you're the only person who ever used it on this show.
Well, then it's
That's
a first.
That's a record, too.
It's a third, too. Anyway, I sat and I wrote it, and I then called my editor at Esquire, and I said, listen, I've written this thing, and I don't know what it is, but I want you to read it, and if you hate it, don't show it to anyone, just send it back. But if you like it and you want to buy it, you cannot put an illustration with it under any circumstances. And so they called the next day and he said that he wanted it and I said, fine. 3 weeks later, of course, they call and they say, did you mean what you said about the illustration? I said, absolutely. He said, because we have a wonderful idea. And I said, what is it? And he said, we just want to do a simple drawing of two maraschino cherries. And I said, that's why I said that.
We have to cut off. We've been talking to Nora Ephron about her new book, Crazy Salad, a collection of her pieces for Esquire, Rolling Stone, and various other magazines. It is a highly readable book because this woman child person can hit you. She is acerbic and asp-like sometimes, but a delightful book. I'm Bob Cromie from the Tribune. Thank you for being with us.